Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of Troy Nunes is an Absolute Podcast. I'm your host, as always, John Casillo, and with me today is Dan Lyons.
Hey, everyone. Happy National Signing Day.
Happy National Signing Day, indeed. It's weird that I didn't have to, like, feel like I was going to die for the last 48 hours.
Yeah, it's also a day that everyone wins, except for LSU fans today.
Somehow.
They usually win, but today they were very, very upset.
Although, if you're a UConn fan, you almost lost because you almost finished second to Yale in your own state.
Oh, let me look at where do UConn finish, or where are they now? Because, like, technically, things are not finished because there are still, like, you know, late additions and the rankings can change a little bit. But
well, there's quite a few. I mean, there's more than normal, if only because of the new rule where if your recruit doesn't become academically eligible, you still lose the spot.
111th, and no one. no one that's ranked nationally, and that's tough because there are thousands of players ranked nationally. Yeah, pretty good. Good job, UConn.
I mean, we can't. There's. I didn't expect to lose to them in 2018, but there is now literally no way we can, and like have any self respect remaining afterward.
No, they're bad. They're like a not very talented bad football team. They were 101st last year. We're talking about UConn recruiting before we're talking about Syracuse recruiting. But I think the they were 99th in 2016. I'm just going back. 99th in 2015. Impressive consistency. And 110th in 2014. Yeah, so like everyone on this roster was part of the 99th or worst best recruiting class in the country.
So you're telling me they're all bad?
They're all bad, Ron. They're all bad Huskies. Yeah. They were 62nd in 2013. That just fell off a cliff. Moving on.
Yeah. At this point, we've lost all our listeners anyway. But yeah, Syracuse had a mostly uneventful National Signing Day. Three players signed with SU today. We had Akeem Dixon, who has been committed since about April or so. Jarvion Howard, another running back, who's only been committed for about a week, and he signed today. And then we also had Caleb Okechukwu, somebody we mentioned last week on the podcast, defensive end from the D.C. area. We actually hit D.C. pretty hard this year. He was our third addition. And then we also have a couple other names floating out there related to what I mentioned earlier, that SU and everybody is not necessarily gonna take those risks as much. With potential non-qualifiers if they're going to lose a scholarship spot. So we have a spot waiting for Fitzroy Gardner. We probably have one for Juwan Jordan, too. And then Dwayne Johnson has nothing to do with academics, I don't believe. I think it's just he didn't decide yet. He's one of the top JUCO cornerbacks in this class. It would be really great to get him, or really anyone that wants to play on the defensive line. Either of those would be great.
Yeah, it was nice to get I'm working on pronunciations here. Okechukwu, right? All right, that's not that bad. It's just Oka plus Odai we already have on our basketball team. Yeah, getting Okechukwu was big. That's probably, you know, I know we all wanted Salah Hadeen, the four-star running back, went to Pitt.
Juked us out during the signing.
He kind of juked us out. Not as bad as the kid who took a Tennessee hat today and threw it, like, I think 75 yards and then picked Georgia in flipping from Alabama, which was just great. It was, like, just this great triangle of just, like, amazing ridiculousness. He threw the hat so far. Salah Hadeen kind of did like the little, like, you know, what DeJuan Coleman did to Kentucky, like, you know, little gamesmanship. Some people were probably, I'm sure there's like one message board thread that's furious about it, and that's fine.
I don't care.
I don't really care. Kids have fun. It's not a big deal.
He even came in with a USC sweatshirt on, so he did the double fake out.
Yeah, he came in with a USC sweatshirt on, which was probably the first indication that he was not going to pick USC.
Yeah,
you know, why would that be the game if he was going to do the hat dance? And then he had the Pitt and the Syracuse hat, no USC hat, and then he faked the Syracuse hat, took off the USC sweatshirt, revealed a Pitt shirt, and then put on the Pitt hat. I was like, okay, fair enough. I guess you really thought hard about this, but good for him. I wish he was going somewhere where we wouldn't have to face him every week.
Exactly, like USC.
Like USC, that would be great. I don't think we'll face them in a while. For a while now, we did that whole thing. I will say that overall, I think it might actually, if we had to pick one of those two guys, obviously Salah Hadeen is the much more lauded player. But I think locking in a defensive lineman, given where our running back situation is right now, with Akeem Dixon in the fold, with Darvian Howard in the fold and with the transfer of Abdul Adams from Oklahoma, I think that was probably more important because I'm very comfortable with where our running backs are right now.
Yeah, I mean, obviously we still have to see those running backs play on the field. We have guys on the roster who we're still not sure about, although I really did think, and I know we talked about this before, I really did think that Mo Neal like came on pretty strong at the end of the year. It was just because at that point, like, we didn't really have a ton going on in the passing game. So, you know, it was a lot of them knowing we were going to hand it off to Neal by the end. But I do think that I know we've kind of floated back and forth here. I could definitely see, you know, if Neal can gain like 10 pounds and get a little bit better with the blocking assignments, having him be the primary running back this year with Markenzie Pierre kind of being the power back, and then having Strickland kind of split out wide to make up for some of the youth out there.
Yeah, I think the blocking is going to be key because it became very clear during the year that that's where Strickland's like true value was, especially when we were passing as much as we were. Obviously, no one was super effective on the ground. Neal, like you said, opened it up a little bit down the stretch and had some big runs. But Strickland was such a better blocker than the other guys on the roster that I think that, you know, it was hard to keep him off the field because there was such a difference in the pass blocking game with him out there. But I think all three of those guys will find roles. I don't know that any of these running backs, the freshman, I think Babers talked about it today. He said this was like a break class where the last two classes were filling needs, like immediate needs.
Right.
Where, you know, you're like, oh, these guys are going to have to play right away. And that became even more apparent with all the injuries that we've suffered. While this class can kind of like, you know, if we have guys that are good enough to play right away, like Trill Williams will probably be in the rotation at corner. That's great, but it's not like a necessity. So we can get on some red shirts in here. We can start to build some depth, which I feel like we haven't had in a decade.
Yeah.
We started to get some at the end of Marone, and then it all fell off a cliff. And it's tough when you have coaching changes.
And like something I talked about in one of the articles today was just like how, and this isn't to say that all of Schaefer's recruiting was bad, but that Schaefer did a lot of the, like, you know, 2 to 3 man class type situations where he'd take some really big gambles on academic qualifiers.
Yeah. There's that one class. Was it 2013 or no?
2014. It was the one
2014, yeah. Which it's not even all his fault. Like, you have to, if you're Syracuse, you're going to take some shots on kids. And he was trying to shoot for like these really, really, like what would have been really big classes for us. And you had a lot of guys just not, we weren't winning one-on-one recruiting battles for all these guys. And then a lot of them just did not pan out for a litany of reasons. So
yeah, I think we lost like, I think two didn't qualify. I think, yeah, that was the year. I think it was Marquise Blair that year. Or was that 2015? That might have been 2015. But KJ Williams didn't qualify. Corey Cooper didn't qualify for the second straight year. There was, I think, Colton Maskell, I think, never even made it onto the field. AJ Long left. I think the top rated recruit that's still on camp that ended up sticking around was Slayton.
And Jonathan Thomas is a decent player, and Denzel Ward played a little bit
until he transferred.
Ishmael ended up being obviously a very good player for us. Alan Edward never made it. He was like a borderline 4-star quarterback. You had Zaire. Like, there were some really good players in this class. Zaire Franklin was big. But then you had like Nace Howard only was here for a bit. Paris Bennett was big. Like, for every big player, Irv Phillips was big. But like, for every big player, you like another guy was never made an impact at all.
Right.
So even where, like, you know, getting Irv Phillips out of New Haven, at West Haven, I guess, bad Connecticut here, is like a huge, great find because he ended up being one of the best players on the team. And, you know, Connecticut's not exactly this crazy recruiting ground. You know, when you're losing probably a third of your class to non-qualifiers, which is something you probably can anticipate, and then guys just leaving, the Nation Howard thing, which is crazy, all this other stuff, like, it's very hard. It's hard to build depth when you're bringing in a class of what was supposed to be 25 guys, and if we went down, I think maybe, how many played 4 years here? Maybe 15?
Yeah, if even. And, like, I don't know what the national average is, but I do, like, I will give Schaefer credit, and I, again, this is something we've discussed, like, he was very, him and his staff were very, very good at that initial evaluation. And like,
they got a lot of guys early that ended up getting
getting better offers because once everyone else was wise, I mean, if we were wise to it as writers, I'm sure staff were wise to it. So people like Florida State, Tennessee, plenty of other bigger programs would wait to see who Schaefer and his guys would offer and go in on early because, like, that, I mean, and that's the you know, 10, a terrible game you have to play if you're program in Syracuse's situation a lot of the times, where if you get in on a guy early, you have a chance of being able to keep him and get some sort of loyalty out of it. But the problem is then you kind of spell out your plans early on. And if you're really good at, you know, that initial phase of recruiting, which Schaefer's staff was, and I think Babers is as well. I'm not sure if it's to the same extent, but Babers' staff seems to be better at closing.
Yeah. I think Schaefer, like you said, was very good at early evaluations. I think Marone's staff was too. I think Schaefer's staff was a bit more aggressive. Schaefer's staff was often the first offer for a guy.
Yeah.
And I don't think we see that as much. We see a little bit of it with Babers. With some more local guys, it seems like they do like the, they kind of branch out throughout the cycle, where we get on like some guys in the Northeast like really quick, and then we start to see where else we're comfortable. Schaefer was like the first offer for a lot of people, and that will, you know, sometimes it'll help. I think it's a little overblown. Like, it's nice to be the first offer for a guy and like show the guy love first, but like when like that May of their junior year rolls around and they're starting to get some buzz, and then they get like an offer every single day, I think it becomes harder to stand out. Right. It can't hurt, but...
But if they're nowhere near you geographically, they probably didn't take a visit
or
anything like that. Like, it does become this sort of weird, like, dynamic. Like, again, like, with all these Florida kids, like, it makes sense to get in about a year out. You've got enough time to visit them once. You've got enough time to have them visit once. Obviously, like, at that point, all of their in-state offers are probably in the door. From everybody except maybe Florida State. And if those offers are coming in Miami, if those three offers are coming in Florida, you're probably not getting them anyway.
Right. You could maybe steal like a kid who gets a late Florida State offer. But you know, there was clearly like plan B for them, and they're like, okay, well, I'll go back to Salto Syracuse where they want me a lot. So you can get those kids. But if Florida State's in early and like this is a priority recruit for them, like you're just not, especially now with Willie Taggart there, you're not going to get that kid. So, I will say I'm impressed this year, aside from the Tyrone Sampson situation, which is mysterious and no one really knows what's going on because it doesn't appear to be academics, and who knows? Like, I know there's rumors out there that we don't, you know, I don't think it's fair to lend credence to them without knowing. Aside from that situation, which is not like someone came in and poached him, like Michigan didn't come in with an offer and steal him, he's not committed anywhere yet, and who knows where he ends up. I kind of expect that he probably won't end up on a FBS roster next year. Based on how this has gone, he's like the only big one that we've lost. Like, the Babers staff did a really, really nice job. I might be forgetting someone, but the Babers staff has done a really nice job of holding on to people this year.
Yeah, I mean, we lost. Yeah, I mean, like, if you count the guys who committed, he's the main one. And then, like, we just kind of fell out with Jaquarius Smith.
Right.
But
I knew there was someone I was forgetting.
Yeah, but that's really it. And, like, I think, like, that's a rarity for us. To be able to say that.
Also, you know, part of that, I think, is the early signing period helped. But, like, there have been plenty of decommitments, like, across the nation. And to only have, really, two, maybe there was someone who was committed early that I can't remember and, like, was out early. But to only have, like, two pretty notable ones in a full, you know, pretty, not like a huge class, but a 19-person class, counting Jawar Jordan, which I don't think we probably should at this point. But so 18 guys, that's a pretty good mark. Like, you don't usually see that, especially... I mean, we were just talking about the Schaefer classes, like, you know, part of that was we were in on guys really early, and then, you know, like we said, there were big schools come, and you'd have a lot of decommitments. So I think that's more the norm, but to hold on to all these guys and really not have a lot of drama at all on either of these signing days is pretty nice.
Well,
it's less good for content, but it's nice in terms of, like, sanity and actually, like, building a program.
Well, especially when, to be honest, like, we had most of these guys, like, ready to go in, like, September, October. And then we really didn't lose any, but we lost like one, two names between, you know, when we beat Clemson and when we proceeded to lose the rest of our games. Like you kind of alluded to there, and something that we wrote about in the site numerous times after the ruling came down, like the early signing day helped out Syracuse and programs like Syracuse so, so much. And I think that's where some of the parity came in around signing day this year. Now, obviously, you know, you still had Alabama had a great class. Ohio State and Georgia still put up historically great classes, and everyone should fear Georgia in the SEC right now. But like you look at some programs like Cincinnati, programs like TCU, Minnesota, programs, and even like Baylor, programs that would usually have some of their top guys poached, early signing period really, really helped them. Washington, too. I mean, Washington's turning into a really scary program out there. They finished about 13th to 15th.
Yeah, I think they were 13 last I checked.
That's a huge, huge step up for them. And I know, like, I wrote about this elsewhere on the comeback around college football playoff time, how, like, they were, like, that typical, like, quote-unquote interloper, the team that wasn't recruiting at a championship level but still competing for conference titles. Like, Chris Peterson, if he does this for another year or two, that's no longer going to be the case. And Washington is going to be miraculously recruiting at, like, a top 15, 20 level, which is insane.
Yeah, they're really impressive because I'm looking at the 24/7 composite rankings. And
two blue-chip quarterbacks.
Yeah, well, they got the 10th and 11th ranked quarterbacks, which is, like, I don't even know. Like, that just doesn't happen. Like, you might take, I know what Alabama does a lot. Also, they'll take, like, one 5-star guy or 4-star guy, and then they'll take another guy who's more of a flyer for depth, and, you know, maybe that guy turns into something. They got, the, like, two guys that were both, like, right in the same area, Colson Yankoff from Idaho and then Jacob Sermon from their backyard in Washington, who are literally, like, the 10th and 11th ranked guys at that position. I think they're, like, 91 and 94 overall. So that's crazy. And they both enrolled early. So, you know, good luck. One of those guys, odds are one of those guys will be good.
He's playing, like, for Oregon State soon.
And then another guy will be playing for Boise. That's true. Years. Actually, no, they probably won't release him to Boise unless the rules change. He'll be playing somewhere. But out of the top 15, like, the only two programs, one of which everyone will guess right away is Notre Dame, but the only two programs that are not in traditional recruiting, I guess Oklahoma, not really, but they get Texas so much, I think they probably count.
Yeah.
Notre Dame and Washington are the only two programs in the top 15 here that are not in traditional recruiting like areas. Everywhere else is, like, you know, the Southeast, pretty much everywhere except for, like, Tennessee, and even Tennessee is able to go into, like, other states obviously surrounding them, are pretty fertile. Oklahoma obviously is Texas, where they recruit more than they do anywhere else. And I'm looking at Washington's breakdown, and it's, like, an interesting mix. Like, they actually got, I think they had a strangely strong in-state classes here for that state.
Yeah.
They have five kids from there. They have two from Oregon, which also had a strong year. Like, the Pacific Northwest was just strong this year for whatever reason. And they got five kids from California, but then they went into Arizona, they went to Utah, and there was just a nice, they got one kid out from Tennessee, one from Texas, one from Nevada, but it was, like, a nice spread of, like, the general Western United States. Notre Dame obviously is, like, its own monster in terms of how they build classes because they, you know, just recruit completely nationally. But then even after that, like, the only other one's Oregon, which was basically just held on for dear life after Taggart left. They were going to be, like, a top 5 to 10 class, and then he left and they finished in 16th.
Still a good job for them. That's better than probably just about every class under Helfrich and maybe even Kelly too, though.
Yeah, Taggart was doing work there, and he is going to be terrifying at Florida State. Like, Fisher was recruiting really well. Fisher was getting top 5 classes. I don't expect to step down under Taggart. I mean, he finished at 11th this year, or he's at 11th right now, in, you know, just a couple weeks of, like, what, basically a month and a half of recruiting.
Can't remember when they were, like, 75th?
Yeah, hilarious. Yeah, I mean, so Oregon is kind of its own thing, too, because of the Nike stuff. They have, like, a unique situation. And then even in the top 25, the only other school that's not in, like, a really solid recruiting area is Nebraska, who is also kind of has a unique situation. Obviously, Scott Frost out there late and also was doing double duty with UCF for a while. So he really was kind of behind the eight ball, and they finished 22nd, or they're 22nd now, held on to some of the big guys that they had, really closed well, and... Like, they're another school that has to go to California. They have to get into Texas probably more than they used to. They did really well in Florida, which obviously Frost built a lot of pipeline. Basically, like, Nebraska was always going to get a couple kids in Florida. Now they have, like, a really solid pipeline because Frost is apparently, like, the nicest guy who every high school coach loves. So expect that. It's going to be tough, especially if we're recruiting against them. So, yeah, four schools out of the top 25 really are in non-traditional recruiting bases and finished that high. So that kind of tells you what, like, how impressive it is that Washington built the class that they did. And I'm also terrified of Scott Frost. He's going to be really, really good there, I think.
Yeah, he's going to be really good there. Hopefully we don't schedule them. It's going to be a bitch to recruit against him down there. Redirecting a little bit more towards Syracuse, SU has dropped now from 48th early in the day to 50th now. We could fall out of the top 50. We also still have those three other spots, so we could bounce right back into that kind of 46 to 50 range. Dan, the one thing I want to call everyone's attention to, and I don't know if you saw it in my article, kind of about you know, where this recruiting class stacks up to previous ones. Right now, 49th or 50th, but 18 players, and I think, you know, that's the thing that needs to be underlined here. Recruiting classes can sometimes be built, as we've seen in the past, on just a boatload of bodies. Like, the numbers are just going to give you that advantage over time. But for us, like, here, having a sub 20 player class right now and being ranked among the top 50 or so, like, that's a hell of an accomplishment. And again, that's without guys like Tyrone Sampson. That's without, you know, several of the names that we thought we could get in on, without several of the names that could still end up in the program. I think that, to me, and I looked at the numbers all the way back to 2013, Schaefer's first class, where he was trying to salvage, you know, what ended up being like a tire fire after Marone left and took most of the staff with him. As long as we finish above 52nd, this will be the best class we've had. But I think because of the different approach to qualifying, this will still be the best, even if we do finish 52nd or so. Again, just because all these guys are going to pretty much end up on campus versus, you know, that 2014 class, the one that Dan and I were talking about earlier. Whole bunch of those guys didn't even make it, you know, to the campus, never mind on the field, where even more of them just never worked out.
Yeah, and I'm looking, because it is a smaller class, and with, you know, without Juwar Jordan, assuming he doesn't make it, it's actually going to probably drop a little bit once they take him off of our ledger here. But overall, in terms of the average, like, rating, there are still six teams that are ranked ahead of us that have worse average. They're, like, on a per-player average, they're worse than us, which, you know, Purdue, Indiana, Cincinnati, Wazoo, Mizzou, and Iowa, who are all in the top, in the 40 to 49 range, who we have a better, like, per-player rating then. So the size of the class, definitely, it's like a combination of like how good the players are and how big the class is. So overall, I think like you said, this is the best class that we've gotten in a long, long time, by almost any metric. Obviously, they might fall below one of the other classes, but that class probably had 22 or 23 guys, which helps bolster it, even if it's just a couple like low three-star guys.
Oh yeah, I mean, the average is great. And then again, you look at each of these players without like going through the list. Pretty much all these guys have, like, you know, multiple peer program, like, offers. This isn't like, you know, the Schaefer years where we'd have a couple guys who had, like, you know, Ohio State offers, and then everybody else were competing against Akron and UMass. I think there's only, like, two guys that I remember off the top of my head that, like, didn't really have the like, lengthy collection of Power 5 offers. You know, Okechukwu obviously would beat out Texas and Arkansas. You know, guys like Kadir White was most of the Northeast, and a lot of the Midwest. Trill Williams, same deal. Like, I think Akeem Williams was just JUCO, came on a little late. Just didn't get the depth of offers, but he still got interest from plenty of the Pacific Northwest Power 5 schools. Like, again, everybody save one or two on this list has Power 5 offers from schools that are in our general ballpark or better. Which I think is the first time we can say that since I started covering this team.
Yeah, and a lot of the guys that are, like, at the bottom here, like the Cooper Lutz and the Willem Frumi were, I think, among, like, the earlier guys to commit. So a lot of the times they won't talk to other coaches because they both, I mean, those two examples, they both seem pretty locked in from the start. But a lot of the times they won't get approached by, like, a comparable team, or they won't give the coach the time of day to get the offer. They won't go camp there to get the offer. So it could be a case where, you know, maybe they would have gotten a couple more, but they just didn't really play the game because they were comfortable with their decision. So
even Frumi's a New Hampshire kid, I believe.
Yeah, he's from New Hampshire, so that's like not a
no one's going up
football.
There.
Yeah, and he has, you know, the normal like Northeast, like smaller schools, and then some FCS offers. I think BC had interest, but Maryland had interest. But yeah, like those kids aren't into a lot of exposure unless they really want to. And obviously he, you know, jumped on with Syracuse pretty early. So it wasn't like a huge thing.
Right. Same thing with Gabe Horan too, who's like a hyper local kid.
Right.
Like he's another one who we were on him pretty quick. I think he was the second or third guy to sign commit to us. In this cycle, and he never really entertained any other offers.
Yeah, so you have to like kind of play the game a little bit to get to like really drive the star ranking up, and to, you know, if you want to go find other offers, like you can, but you know, when these kids commit early and they aren't interested in really entertaining other things and the schools aren't going to, like, go out of their way to find the kids in New Hampshire, then, you know, you're just not going to get, like, these giant offer lists. So, you know, sometimes it means a lot, sometimes it doesn't. I'm pretty thrilled with, I mean, I don't think there's anyone here that, like, just feels like a, you know, a guy that's going to be a throwaway or a guy that just won't contribute. Like, I think everyone here has the potential to contribute, which I don't think we could say every single year. Obviously, you know, you always look for the best in all the commits that you get, but I think everyone here seems like a pretty legit FBS ACC-level player, and, you know, at worst, hopefully everyone here will be, you know, a solid rotational player going forward. So I'm pretty thrilled with this class overall. Obviously, it would have been nice to have our four-star center, but things happen. But overall, like, I think this is a pretty exciting group.
Yeah, and I know somebody was kind of joking in the comments, like, you know, it's that it was weird not seeing any two stars, and that's really, I mean, that's something that's changed immediately under Babers, but I think this is, again, just to, like, hammer this point home, it's the first class that I can remember where, like, you didn't really see a two-star rating from any service for these guys. Either they were unrated just because of whatever reason, but they were three stars everywhere else, or they were three stars across the board, or they were a four with a three that maybe drove them down in the composite rank. Just in general, a really high quality class. And again, this is what Power Conference recruiting should look like. And it's amazing it's taken us this long to get to this point.
Yeah. I think Kadir White and Edward Hendricks both have four stars somewhere. Yeah. I think, like, and Trill, they're three-star composite guys. Trill's a four-star composite guy. So he's like the lead guy in this class, mm-hmm. I think partially because his name is amazing, but also because he, you know, just has been, like, kind of a stud the whole time. But I like that his last offer was Lane Kiffin on December 5th. Like, did Lane think he was going to come in here and swoop him?
Yeah,
like,
he did.
No owl puns intended.
Lane train.
Yeah, I mean, he's been, like, the number one guy, but, like, depending on what your favorite recruiting site of choice is, I think we both just kind of default to the 24/7 composite, if only because it combines everything, and also I think their site's just laid out the best. But White and Hendricks, I believe, both have four stars elsewhere. So, yeah, this is, like, and I couldn't tell you the last time we even had, like, you piece together all the different sites and take, like, the most generous rankings. I don't think we've had a 3-4 stars in one class group in a long time. So, very good. Good job, Dino.
I'll take it. All right. Maybe before we jump into basketball, why don't we talk a little beer, Dan?
Sounds good.
After you, what have you been drinking?
I went to a Ballast Point event in here in New York last week, I think last Thursday, where they were just doing a tasting at, you know, some bar in the West Village. I thought they would have a little bit more, like, newer stuff. It was really more basic, but it was still free Ballast Point, so no real complaints here. So they have their Stolpen and their Grapefruit Stolpen. They also had the Fathom IPA, which is a relatively new release that I had not had yet.
Yeah, it's pretty
good.
Which
is actually really good. It's, like, a very different IPA than, like, their normal, you know, obviously than their Stolpens, which are, you know, more of these normal, like, West Coasts, and then they have their flavors. The Fathom was a little bit of a different style. I really liked it, though, so I enjoyed that. For the Super Bowl, I was drinking the Flesh and Blood IPA from Dogfish, which is a pretty juicy IPA with, it uses lemon zest and blood orange for this really nice citrusy flavor, but not, like, beyond what, like, your normal citrusy IPA is. I thought it worked really well, and I'm always, sometimes blood orange I feel like can be a little bit much, and this worked really well. So I was very happy with that, and I ended up having more of those than I intended during the Super Bowl. And then I also had a Jinx by Magic Hat, which I believe is their Scottish barrel-aged. It was their Scotch Ale, which was also very good. I think that was a limited release, so it was actually producer Lewis picked up a six-pack of those, so I got to try one of those. So those are the most exciting things. Definitely recommend all of those. Obviously, if you've listened to this at all, Ballast Point comes up every so often. So that's an obvious one. But the other two were also very good.
Nice. Yeah, I had a busy weekend of drinking. Drank a little too much during the Super Bowl, to say the least. That was not because I was invested in either team. I actually hate both teams. But it was great to see New England lose in any fashion. I had from McKellar, had a Windy Hill New England style IPA. That one was all right. Had a bottle of from Brewery Tarot, Sour in the Rye Pog. It's their sour in the rye with passion fruit, orange, and guava. It was really, really good. Nice tropical sour from them. Had from Monkish, had their Tom, Dick, and Henry triple IPA. Had a West Coast style IPA from Hop Saint Name Dropper. I've mentioned that one a couple times. My buddy was over at his house at the Super Bowl. This is why he drank way too much during the Super Bowl. Had like a lot of like aggressive kind of barrel aged stuff that we were kind of imbibing. So had a Speedway Stout barrel aged from 2015. So it put some age on that. That adds a little bit more on the booze front. Had a Black and Blue and Red All Over. It was kind of a dark blueberry, blackberry, and raspberry sour. From Brewery Tarot that was super good. Had some Sneakers as Kicks, double IPA from Monkish. And then a 2014 bottle of Melange number 3. It's a strong ale from the brewery. And yeah, that's where things kind of hit the tipping point. would not recommend barrel-aged beers during the Super Bowl, Dan.
Or Eagles Patriots Super Bowls.
Or definitely not those. I could do without those forever. I've already had experience two of them, and I don't really want another one.
Was there a team you were actually pulling for? Like, I know it was begrudgingly so, but were you begrudgingly pulling for one of those two sides?
See, like here's my problem. Like for me, I wanted to keep the Trump card on Tom Brady, like just to the Giants. And pointing and laughing at Philly fans every time they like had something to say that they've never won anything was always a good time. I wouldn't have minded if they flip flopped. Like if the Eagles had won the last time these two teams faced one another, at least Donovan McNabb would have gotten a title.
Yeah.
This time it then became like this. Like I mean, it was fine. I really love the fact that they used the college game plan to win the Super Bowl.
Yeah, I mean, I love like I don't really have anything against. The Patriots, the problem with the Patriots is just like the fans are so damn annoying at this point. Garbage. And they're so weirdly thin skinned for a team that's won so much.
There's something very Trumpy about them. And I'll leave it at that.
They're just like, you would think any slight is like
everyone's
this
out to
giant
get
thing. And it's just so annoying. Just enjoy the fact that you have 5 rings and
walk away.
Like, appreciate, and be like, you have that over everybody. So just, like, use it. Like, just say, hey, we have 5 rings, so we're good. We don't need to be as defensive as humanly possible about every possible slight against Tom Brady or Bill Belichick. They are both, like, it's just ridiculous. You have the best coach and quarterback ever at the same time and 5 Super Bowls. The Eagles, I feel like I had more hatred towards the Eagles in my life when... after the Freddie Mitchell game against the Packers.
I recall.
Which,
the 4th and 26.
4th and 26. And then I ran into Freddie Mitchell at the Walter Camp dinner in New Haven a couple years ago. And my dad was like, hey, this, you know, he used to play for the Eagles. I was like, oh, who is it? And he goes, Freddie Mitchell? And I was like, oh my God, there's literally not one former Eagle I would least rather meet right now than Freddie goddamn Mitchell. And I met him. And I don't know. Otherwise, I have friends who are Eagles fans. They're not the Phillies, so I don't have any personal animus towards them otherwise. Like, I guess the 4th and 26 game was, what, like, 14 years ago now, so I could probably be over it.
Nah, those things don't die. I still hate the Niners for what they did to us in 2001 or whatever.
It helps that the Packers have won a Super Bowl since.
Right.
Yeah, so, like, I have more annoyance towards like, the Seahawks now, and obviously, like, the Vikings and... Mostly the Vikings. The Bears are just sad, and the Lions are just even more sad. But yeah, so I don't know. I was happy the Eagles beat the Vikings, and I think the Eagles, like aside from the franchise that they play for, were really fun as a group.
Right.
And the Nick, like the way they utilized, like it was a very modern NFL team, and the fact that they got the performances they did at Nick Foles was super admirable, and the fact that they just seemed to have like a lot of fun doing it, and were in so many ways like the anti-Patriots. So I definitely found myself rooting for the Eagles pretty strongly. I wouldn't have been like devastated if they had lost, because I don't hate the Patriots as much as a lot of other people, but I was pretty happy with the result. And also all of the videos from Philadelphia afterwards made it worth it, I think. Aside from the horse one, I didn't need to see that.
See, for me, like, I had the conflict of, like, as a four-sport New York fan, like, I have so much built-up hatred for all four Philly teams, in particular the Phillies, for what they did to me in the mid-2000s, that, like, I can never get that back.
That would definitely be more like a kind of game changer. I just have the one. So, I mean, the Sixers and Nets don't really have anything.
I don't really mind the Sixers, because the current Sixers are a hell of a lot of fun. But, like, for me...
Yeah, right.
But then, on the other hand, like, some of my best friends are, like, just fervent assholes, which just puts me in this, like, weird spot where, like, I'm going to lose either way.
I also feel like there's more, like... Obviously, I feel like Philly's one of those cities where everyone roots for the same teams, and Boston's very much the same. But I feel like the Philadelphia teams, even though they, like, seem to support each other, don't have this, like, shared identity that the Boston teams do.
Right, and, like, Pittsburgh does, and...
Yeah, I don't know totally why. Like, there are a couple of cities like that, but the Boston teams, I think it's just because they all won so much in this, like, short period of time. They're kind of like this one big group of sports, and the Philly teams have all been so different. It's cool to see Embiid at, like, the Super Bowl and seeing, like, guys from all the other teams, like, supporting each other, like, the whole week. But, like, the Eagles had their heyday in, like, the early the McNabb years, and then the Phillies won the World Series, like, after the Eagles had already flamed out, and the Sixers had, like, the AI thing before that. So, like, they've never really been good at the same time, and now they're kind of maybe getting there. We'll see, because the NFL stuff is so fleeting, and who knows if the Sixers actually, like, get to where they're supposed to be going, and the Phillies didn't screw off. But
I feel like it's, like collective underdogism. Like,
yes.
Philly and Boston in particular, like, have... I mean, I always joke, and at this point, I don't, people are going to get pissed off at me. I don't really care. Because I always joke that, like, San Francisco, Philly, and Boston all suffer from, like, the same disease. As instead of defining themselves by what they are, they sit around defining themselves by, like, the city they're comparing themselves to all the time. So, like, Philly and Boston do a lot of comparing themselves to New York. San Francisco does a lot of comparing itself to New York and Los Angeles. Like... And that's not to play, New York LA elitist, but just more to say, like, those cities do a lot of, like, chip on their shoulders stuff. And that can be endearing at times, but I think that's when you see more of that collectivism. Like, San Francisco does it with their teams, too. They didn't count the Warriors as theirs until they started winning. And then suddenly San Francisco loved the Warriors. But I think that's where some of it comes from.
Yeah, that makes sense. It wasn't my ideal Super Bowl matchup, but I was pretty happy with the outcome. I also have, like, some pretty good Philly fan, Eagle fan friends who I was happy for, because, when a team hasn't won ever, like, there's something there, when you're not a Giants or Cowboys or a Washington fan. So, yeah, that was my Super Bowl experience, overall. Not bad. I just also appreciate that we've had, like, since the awful, awful Seahawks-Broncos Super Bowl, we've had some really, really good games, which is nice.
I mean, really, since, like, I'd say... Since, like, 2000, we've had some... 2001, sorry. My team screwed that up. Since 2001, we've had some really great Super Bowls, and, like, maybe it has to do with Tom Brady, but in general, like, the Super Bowl kind of sucked for, like, the majority of, like, the first 30 years. And then in the, like, 22 seasons since, like, it's been better by a significant margin, especially again in, like, the last, like, 17, 18 seasons. Like, the large majority of those games have been pretty close and pretty good.
Yeah, I mean, like, the only duds, like, Broncos Panthers really wasn't actually that good. I forgot, like, that was not as close as I thought.
Raiders Bucks
and also
sucked.
Like, Seahawks Broncos was terrible, and then, like, going back, like, Saints Colts was, like, not that close, but it was pretty fun.
Yeah, well, just the fan bases and, like, New Orleans being there was just fun, but, like, Raiders Bucks was bad. Seahawks,
yeah, but that's, like, you're going back, like, over a decade now.
Well, yeah,
there.
Seahawks Steelers was unwatchable.
Yeah, it was a bad game. It was, like, closer than the store, but, like, it was a bad game. Colts Bears is bad. Prince
was
awesome.
It was boring.
Colts Bears is bad. Obviously Bucks Raiders was just, like, a bludgeoning, as was Ravens Giants. Sorry, John.
We won two Super Bowls after that, so it's not a big deal.
Yeah, you're doing all right. I don't really remember. I remember watching Broncos Falcons, but I don't really remember the details.
And that game, like, I just hated because at the time, like, when the Giants were bad when I was a kid, like, I mean, the Giants got good very quickly thereafter, but, like, I just really was a big Brett Favre fan. So I was, like, fervently rooting for Brett Favre, like, against the Broncos the year before, and then after the Packers lost, I just, like, hated the Broncos, and my brother was, like, a big John Elway fan. So then the next year, I was, like, our high school mascot was the Falcons, and, like, our town mascot was the Falcons. So I was, like, big in on the Falcons the following year, and, you know, they obviously messed that up.
But my only, like, long memory of that Falcons era is that when you played Madden for a couple years there, anytime you used Jamal Anderson, the only thing they had programmed to say about him is that he only fell forward. That's so, like, that just programmed in my brain that Jamal Anderson only fell forward. Like, he never got taken down and, like, went backwards.
I remember so much about that team. The Dirty Bird. Freaking, wasn't, like, Curtis Conway on that team?
Think so. LeBron James just won a game on basically the Leitner play. And it's in, like, double overtime against the T-Wolves.
Why did it have to be the T-Wolves?
Yeah, they won it. I think it was double overtime. It was 140 to 138. Right. And they just threw from not quite mid-court on the sideline. Yeah, like, three-quarters court. Threw to LeBron, and he had a fadeaway jumper on Andrew Wiggins from just beyond the foul line. And it was pretty remarkable.
That's highly unfortunate. I mean, I want LeBron to like do well, I feel, for the most part, but not against Minnesota. I love watching the Wolves.
I like the Wolves too. I don't know what I want for LeBron here. I don't know what like I don't really want him to like. I don't have care if he stays in Cleveland. I don't think there's any future for him there. I just don't know where I want him to go that he could realistically go. I don't really want him to go to the Lakers because I feel like he's just
hard pass. Like,
yeah, A, it's the Lakers, and ooh, and B, like, they're not going to be good enough for a while. And by the time they're good enough, he's not going to be good enough, I don't think.
I could see him go to New Orleans. I mean, he won't go to New Orleans, but I'd love to see him go there. Just, like, for fun.
Yeah, I mean, that would never happen. They're just not.
He'd go to Minnesota. That'd be fun. Do that.
I just don't see him going to, like, a market like that.
No, he won't.
Obviously, the Rockets is like the big one,
yeah.
Which would be interesting. I don't know how he would fit into that system. Obviously, I think he could. I just don't know how. I feel like you know, we'd have the normal like February thing where like he gets annoyed at something, and the Rockets are like, "Oh, it was better when it was just Paul and Harden." I think if he wanted to, he could fit into that system. I think the Spurs would be really interesting, him and Pop.
I could buy the Spurs. I think, yeah. Like the problem is, I'd love for him to go to the Knicks, but he's not doing that. And now that everything sucks for the Knicks, who knows where that goes. But yeah, I could see him going to the Rockets, but I also don't see him giving up money. And if the problem now is that if he's not going to give up money, like I don't know where he can go that has the room to sign him that's actually going to be competitive. Because like not many teams have the room.
That's the problem is like there's just very few teams that like could get him that he might want to go to and could win a title with him, assuming you take out the Warriors, because good Lord, like, I think what David Stern did to shut down Chris Paul from going to the Lakers is pretty shady. I think they should absolutely shut down LeBron from going to the Warriors if that was... I don't think he would, because I don't think he would get any credit for any titles they won.
Yeah.
But, like, just the inkling of that being a possibility is, like, so ludicrous.
Yeah, I really hope that doesn't happen, just I hate the Warriors so much.
Yeah, I don't even hate the Warriors, but, like, come on. Really? Like, what are we doing here if we do that? Like, I don't think it's going to happen. They would have to unload so much just for the possibility of getting him, and they would put their own depth in such danger at the chance that he changed his mind that it would be a huge risk for that franchise. But, man, that would just be stupid.
Please do it. No, please do it now, because they're going to have to probably trade Clay to make it happen.
Yes.
Trade Clay to the Knicks.
Yeah, I don't know what the Knicks are doing.
Listen, man, I'm in mourning. I was supposed to see Kristaps play against the Clippers in early March, and now I feel like I'm going to end up not seeing him at any point during his Knicks career. Like, I didn't see Melo live the entire time, despite the fact that I went to a Knicks game every year, because for some reason there was, like, an injury every single time. And I feel like Kristaps is going to be the same thing.
I'm going to venture a guess that Blake Griffin was still on the team when you bought those tickets as well.
Yes. He was.
That's hilarious.
And I'm not even going to talk about how much I spent on the tickets. Me and my buddy, who's also a big Knicks fan and a Syracuse grad, actually, out here. We spent significantly more than we'd probably have to spend on those tickets right now, which is unfortunate.
I would imagine.
Second level at the Staples Center, no matter who you're playing, is probably going to be more expensive than what we're going to see, which is like the Agua Caliente Clippers of Ontario versus the Westchester Knicks.
Yes, the Westchester Knicks. I have to imagine that any time the Knicks play there, it's super inflated, because I'm sure there's just a lot of East Coast transplants.
Well, yeah. I have to pay the New York markup for every – even the Mets get the New York markup out here.
Yeah. It's unfortunate.
Which is fine. I accept my fate. I go to my one game per year as a visiting fan. And otherwise, I get the rest of my live game fix going to see, you know, the Dodgers drub the Padres for $7 or I luck into, you know, either box seats from friends or whatever, or I get to go to, like, you know, the Suns are in town and nobody wants to see the Suns and Clippers, so then you get to go to that for like $15.
Oh, hey, Ohio State beat Purdue. We're just breaking news that everyone's going to hear like 12 hours later.
Yeah, that's fine. On that note, probably talk a little bit more Syracuse, because I'm sure there's already like outrage at this point. About
we should actually put in like time markers for like there's NBA content from like 34 to 49
it was
because
NFL
LeBron
content.
Did something crazy. It wasn't planned. LeBron did something crazy in front of me.
And there was NFL content from like 27 to.
Yes. Oh, actually, yeah, that's what we were on. We were on the Super Bowl first, and then NBA happened, like, mid-sentence. Yeah, maybe we should do that, so people who are their ears light on fire every time you talk about paid athletes.
God forbid.
Yes.
But yeah.
Although, we are going to have some paid college athletes this year, which I feel like no one talked about, the 3-on-3 tournament thing.
Oh, yeah, I forgot all about that.
Who? No one on our team could do it, though, because we have no seniors.
Hmm.
Sad.
Unfortunate. Next year, maybe, sort of. But yeah, on current things with Syracuse basketball, Syracuse not only won, they beat Louisville of all teams, and they beat them on the road. I know I didn't pick Syracuse to win this game, but I did mention that I was tempted to, and that counts, because of the fact the fact that they were facing a first-year head coach, and I'd always take Jim Boeheim against the first-year head coach. And lo and behold, that first-year head coach came through when we needed him most and started just ripping J's from outside instead of just staying in the paint and getting us into foul trouble / getting the entire team fouled out.
I think we talked about it last week on the podcast, too. Like, we weren't, like, obviously fully previewing Louisville because it was a couple games away, but like, we discussed, like, you know, Boeheim versus Padgett approaching against the zone for the first time. It's obviously a lot different when you're doing it for real than, like, coaching against it /, like, seeing Pitino do it, who obviously was very, very good against it almost every time we played. The last 5 minutes of Louisville was so fascinating and mystifying. Like, they scored. I'm going to pull up the play-by-play and be obnoxious, and maybe we'll edit it out. I'm going to look to see how many baskets in a row they scored. Until before they decided to stop doing the thing that worked every single time. It was unbelievable.
I think it went from like a 12-point lead to like a 2-point lead, like very quickly.
Yeah, did we ever give up the lead?
No.
No, yeah, we were up 65-53, which I think is the high water mark of our lead.
Yeah.
With 7:36 left in the game after two Tyus free throws. And then a tip-in, a dunk, a tip-in, a Mahmoud jumper, which was, like, I think from, like, not even the foul line, a layup, two free throws, then they missed a three, and then they missed another three, and that's, like, we're just, like, they cut it down from that 11- or 12-point lead to a 2-point lead in the course of 3 minutes on, like, five or six straight possessions where they scored, and then they just started light, like, going crazy from outside, and they didn't hit any of them. Like,
right.
They weren't even getting great looks. And then eventually they got back to the free throw line, but it was after we had brought our lead back to, like, 7. So it was just so asinine. Like,
they were 5 of 21 from outside.
It was really bad. And obviously our defense is good. Like, we're at the point where we can, I think, pretty safely say, if nothing else, the defense that we have is very good. The advanced statistics bear this out. I know there are stretches during these games where we, like, look very frustrating on defense, but overall, like, per 40 minutes, we are a very good defensive team. Louisville just, it was like, I don't know, we're going back to, like, old Madden references again. I feel like when I played Madden, like, there were some plays, every year there was, like, one play in the playbook that was basically unstoppable, and it was so boring to just use that play over and over, so you'd mix it up, and you'd only use it when you get it, like, bailed out. And it almost felt like Padgett was, like, tired of using that little, like, tight end Z route that you could get a first down on every single time. So he started, like, throwing deep, and then it just got away from him. Like, then the computer took over and decided it was going to win the game. It was just so ridiculous that they didn't keep on feeding it inside, because there was no reason not to. Nothing happened. Nothing changed that, like, necessitated that change in strategy.
Well, yeah, and, like, if you look at, like, who took all these shots, like, the guy, like, if you're going to win that game, I don't even think it takes a, you know, seasoned coach to realize that, like, if you just kept handing the ball to Ray Spalding and VJ King, you were probably going to win.
Yeah, it was Mahmoud, Spalding, and King down the stretch. Adele had a bad game. He was 2 of 9 from the field, 10 points. Snyder did nothing. There were a couple of guys off the bench who had some, I mean, Spalding was the main guy off the bench who had 18, but, like, they were doing all the damage, and all of a sudden we're watching Snyder and Adele jack threes, and, you know, as we said, they were 5 for 21 for the team. Syracuse actually 6 for 13. That was, like, a really nice three-point performance, and obviously that's not the team's strength, but, you know, I think 6 for 13 is, obviously, if you're shooting 46%, you're happy, but I think that's, like, a, you know, appropriate amount of shots from three this team should be taking, right. And, you know, Brissett keeps on adding that to his arsenal a little bit. Frank hit some huge ones. Battle didn't take too many because he didn't have it, but
he realized it.
Had a really nice game.
That's the thing. He realized it, and that was the thing missing from, like, the Virginia game and some of the other games that we, like, lost close, was that, like, Battle didn't realize when he didn't have it, and then on top of that, like, Frank and O'Shea weren't hitting from outside either. So when you don't have any three ball and you don't really have a lot of ball movement ability, like, that's kind of what happens. Like, this game we only had 9 assists, but at the same time, like, 9 assists on 25 baskets isn't horrendous, and everybody got involved. Like, Bayer was the only player who didn't have an assist. I'd say that that's, like, a nice step forward, even if ball movement's still kind of bad.
It looked better than the numbers looked, but I think part of the other thing was that Louisville's guards could not stay in front of Howard or Battle at all, especially when they had McMahon in, the three-point gunner, who hit, like, one really deep three, and that freaked me out. And then the rest of the game, he had the one deep three, and then he also got fouled on a really asinine play by, I forget who it was, I think it was Howard,
I don't remember. Frank.
Was it Frank?
Yeah.
Yeah, he fouled him on a three, and the dude flopped, I thought, pretty clearly, but got to the line, hit all three, obviously. But otherwise, like, his main contribution was playing Matador to Battle and Howard every time they got on him one-on-one. So, like, while usually I'm kind of annoyed with how we go right to the dribble drive, in this case, Snyder couldn't defend us, and McMahon, when he was in, which was only 9 minutes, it seemed like a lot more, but he was in for, like, a good deal of that, like, mid-second half, and, man, he could not defend either of those guys for at all. Like, every time we got a one-on-one and it's him, we just took it right to the hole, and it was gorgeous.
Yeah, I mean, obviously you're not going to be able to replicate that all the time, but I'll take that. I'll take the little bit of ball movement. I'll take the really nice job on the boards, even if the offensive rebounding has definitely fallen off since ACC play started. And I'll also take Dolezal being a pretty accurate shooter, quietly.
Yeah, if he can just add that mid-range and take, like, afraid to say take a couple more of those, because I feel like that's when he, you know, has a 3-for-10 game. But, like, we've seen a couple games now where he's had something, and if he can get us 8 points a night, I'm thrilled. Like, that's fine. I would take that for sure. Also, getting to the free throw line, taking 29 shots from the free throw line, very nice, and hitting a good amount of them. Very solid. And it wasn't just Brissett this time. Battle was 11 for 11, which is huge.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Battle being perfect from the line is huge. It made him such a threat. And obviously, again, the fact that he wasn't settling for outside shots unnecessarily. And he still scored 25 points. I think, you know, that's the type of game that if people are talking about his pro prospects, you have to see more of that in order to really start projecting him into the draft conversation in earnest.
Yeah, I mean, being able to, like, handle the ball pretty well and, like, have that kind of dominant streak in terms of being able to break guys down and take it to the hole and finish well and get to the line. Like, that's where he's going to make his money. I don't think he's ever, you know, I think his 3-point shot will come along, but I don't think he's ever going to be like a lights out shooter.
No.
He needs to be able to knock him down, and he needs to probably improve on that. Although a lot of that's just like, this team is so deficient from there that he takes bad shots out of necessity sometimes, or he feels like he has to. I overall, though, like, his strength is going to be just being a really good athlete and getting the ball to the hole. So, yeah, it was nice to see him play an efficient game because obviously he's kind of trailed off a little bit in the last couple of weeks, where earlier in the year when we had some more depth and we were playing obviously weaker teams, but, like, this was the type of game he was having. And to see him have it against a team that, you know, Louisville's not great, but they're still pretty talented. They're, you know, blue-chip guys all over this roster and it's, you know, the same, largely the same roster that Pitino would have been coaching. It was a pretty nice sign, I thought.
Yeah, and honestly, like, as much as Battle's been trailing off, like, you look at the numbers, and, like, they're not necessarily as bad as we think. He also was the only player to not commit a foul, besides Braden Bear. I commend him for that, considering everybody else had at least three.
Yeah, Bam's foul management, and this was, like, a very, very closely called game. Both sides, really. I mean, Louisville, we actually took more foul shots, but Louisville has 10 players, and we have, like, six. And Brandon Bear, shout out to him. But the fact that Boeheim was able to manage the fouls and without anyone fouling out until I think it was like, what, 1:36 or so when Brissette fouled out, like, that's pretty remarkable. I tweeted after the game, like, it was a breakdown in Padgett coaching the offense, and then Boeheim just very masterfully having his guys in position to stay in the game and play well enough on defense. Obviously, that run of interior of like interior scoring for Louisville was in part because we couldn't play super aggressively on the block. But like overall he managed the game super well. And I feel like every year there's like two or three games where you just get reminded that Boeheim's like really good at this. And it's easy to kind of forget that when you have some of the other losses that are annoying. But like every so often he just has a game where he flat out outcoaches someone. And it's always a nice reminder that we do in fact have a Hall of Fame coach who is worthy of being in that group.
Too true. Dan, before we kind of sign off here, I think 4-3 with a win in the ACC tournament gets us in. Do you agree?
I agree. Because the 4-3 is going to be a battle to get there. No pun intended. Again, I feel like it's been a couple times this podcast. We need to beat Wake. We should not have lost to Wake last time. That Wake and the Notre Dame loss haunt us, really.
Florida State, too, really.
And Florida State's, like, at least they're decent. And UVA, right. The first UVA game we should have stolen. Like, there are a couple of losses.
And St. Bonaventure, yeah.
So those really, games all haunt us.
We should be, like, you know, a top 25 team, but whatever.
Yeah, with no offense, like, somehow. beat Wake, beat BC again. Don't have one of those weird road BC games where you blow them out the other time. Then this game is, like, way too frustrating. We do not need that in our lives. It's not healthy. And then like NC State surging and Miami, I think is still really talented. I think we could get them. UNC, I'm not super impressed with, but like there's no gimme game here. Clemson plays really hard. That's gonna be a really tough game, even though it is at the Dome to end the year. So like, yeah, you're gonna have to steal two games from ranked teams because I'm assuming NC State will be ranked next week probably, or by the time, I mean pretty soon because they've been on a tear. And then you have to beat Wake and BC. Like, you just have to take those two games. You can't let up. And then, yeah, if we go 4-3 and finally win our first game in the ACC tournament, if we finish 4-3, we'd be 9-9, right?
We'd go 9-9, but we'd have wins over Louisville. But I say, like, as far as, like, tier one-ish, Louisville, Buffalo, and then... and then NC State.
Any of those other two wins will be a tier one win.
Like, right. So we'd have like five tier one wins, and like people were, you know, that one article the other day was talking about the comparison between like our resume and Louisville's, and we actually look better by the numbers, and we had the head to head.
Yeah. I mean, we've seen that I think you actually said like verbatim, we've seen that this doesn't always matter because Wake Forest last year, who we beat and got passed over for. But yeah, no, I think 9-9 in the ACC, and then please, God, get an ACC tournament win in Brooklyn, please. That's like one of the weirdest bugaboos, like monkeys on the back, that I can remember with any Syracuse team. I guess having a monumental football win and then losing out is another one now. a fun tradition that we started. But this is like, we've been in the ACC for a minute now. Like, it's been a while. And we should have at least one. And I know we weren't eligible for one, and that hurt. But come on. some of our teams were good.
There are some reasons. Like, the 2014 team was, like, literally in a free fall and had been for, like, half a month when they got to the NC State game. And then...
Oh, I was there. I'm aware.
Yeah, so you know how it goes with, like, the double bye and all the other bullshit. And then, obviously, you know, us facing Pitt in anything is fraught with consequences.
I would like to face Pitt in the ACC tournament this year.
I'll
put that out there.
People were joking, said we should really want to finish, like...
Ninth?
Yeah, well, you want to finish ninth. You want to finish, like...
Oh, how does it work?
You want to finish, like, 10th, because then if you finish 10th, you then face the worst team.
The problem is that Wake Forest would beat Pitt, and then we'd lose to Wake Forest again.
Yeah, but you know
what? I would take my chances. No, because yeah, you're right. If you finish ninth, you play the eighth team automatically, right?
That's what happened last year when we faced Miami, who was better than the record.
Yeah, so right now we're going to finish in that same range. So if we finish 9-9, assuming we don't go on a tear here and beat like four ranked teams, we're going to be probably like, if we do the 4-3 thing that we're saying, we'll be 9-9, which will be right in that like probably 8-11 range somewhere based on tiebreakers. I mean, let me see how it usually shakes out here.
Give me a 10. Want to face Pitt.
Pitt finally coming through for us and winning a postseason game when they're not supposed to. And then so we could face them would be great. And then I'd be terrified that we're going to lose to Pitt. Like, I know Pitt's hot garbage, but I would be terrified that we're going to lose to them no matter what.
Well, the thing is, too, we said this last year, like us getting the 9 seed over like Wake or like whoever was below us, I felt like it was absolute BS because then they got an easy game against whoever was last. And then the next round, they got an easier game than we had against Miami.
And there's no benefit to being being 8 or 9. Like they don't look at that. I assume they don't look at that in the tournament room and say, oh yeah, Syracuse finished 9th, so they should go over the team that just won the tournament game. Like yeah, give me the data point here to take advantage of. I'm looking at last year. We were 10-8 last year. It actually was. There was more weighted towards the top because there was like a bunch of really bad teams: NC State, Pitt, and BC all had four fewer wins. So yeah, last year 9-9 was Wake Forest, and they, like you said, they finished 10th with a chance. So let's say the 10-8s turned into 9-9s, that'd be like the 7-11 range is basically what we're looking at because Georgia Tech last year was 8-10 and they finished 11th.
Yeah, again, give me the 10 so that we can face Pitt and then. And then that, and then there's your win. And then there's your win. There's your neutral site win. Like that game, winning that game counts just as much as beating whoever we'd faced in 8-9 game, like Virginia Tech. So to me, like, I'd rather get that and then have a chance of getting another win in the next round with some momentum.
Yeah, because like in this, based on the standings right now, we would beat Pitt assuming they beat Wake Forest. We would play Pitt, and then who would we get in the following round? We get the 2.
I think we would get the 2. I don't even know what the ACC bracket looks like.
It's so convoluted. I'm gonna pull up last year's just as I now care about this.
No, I think this is absolutely worth diving into just from the standpoint of like.
I'm just totally hypothetical. All right, the ACC tournament bracket last year, the 2 was Virginia.
I know. Yeah, that's the thing is that you get to face the 7. Like
is it the 7 and then the 2 faces the 7?
Yeah.
Am I right?
Yeah. So then that's the thing. Like if you're the 10, you were in a much better place than if you are than 8 or 9 because you get to face and probably beat the 15. Then you get to potentially beat the 7.
The 7 right now, Louisville.
Oh boy.
We're going on a run, everyone. If the standings stay exactly the same as they are today, which is very likely with a full month left of the season, we are going on a run, kids.
Yeah, but you hear me on this, right? It's so much better to be the 10 in this stupid tournament.
I think that's that's like borne out in terms of like just seeing how like I want to know if you like who's finished 10th in the ACC the last couple of years and seeing how it's gone for them.
Well, the problem is we've had so few tournaments that have had all the teams.
Right, because we had the 14th, because we've had us. We were out 1 year and was Louisville out 1 year already.
Yes. So far I'm back to 2015 now. And nope, the 10 seed did not win a game in 2015, but we weren't in the tournament. And it was Pitt, so maybe we would have messed that up anyway. 10 seed wins at least a game pretty much every year. And
I feel like often, like not every year, but often the 10 seed in the tournament in the ACC is probably on the fringe of the tournament.
Yeah. Things to consider.
Yes. So we want to finish 10th if we can. I know that we're going to play and try to win all these games because at the same time, you don't want to like give away games. But if we could somehow have it work where we finish 10th but also win 4 games, that'd be great. I don't know if that's possible, but it could be because I think we could have like a jumble at 9-9.
Fair. Well, guess we'll see.
This also illustrates that the ACC should probably find a better way to do this.
Yeah, like leaving out the bottom few teams.
That would make sense. It's like any team that... Why are we bringing any team...
That was absolute garbage.
Why are we bringing Pitt? Do we just leave Pitt home?
That's fine. Leave Pitt home.
I know we want to play Pitt, but like aside from that point, unless you can guarantee Syracuse that it can play Pitt, Pitt doesn't provide anything. Pitt, like, Kevin Stallings doesn't want to be there.
I said this when we were in the Big East, too. I think 12 is the max.
Like, I get, like, the whole automatic bid thing. I get that, like, technically any team can still make the tournament. Like, I understand how college basketball works. I don't think we really need teams that are not at least, like, on the bubble to be in these postseason tournaments.
Well, and, like, if you're the 15th place team in the ACC, are you actually traveling to go see that trash?
No, and if you're a Wake Forest fan, you're not, because you're Wake, or a Pitt fan. Like, Pitt fans aren't traveling to Pitt to see games right now.
Right. Yeah, they're not driving to Brooklyn.
They're certainly not going to Brooklyn. No.
Anyway, we are in double overtime here. So
so you're about to take a turnaround jumper off of a crazy inbound pass to win the game.
100%. All right. That was Dan. I'm John. Thank you, everybody, for listening to Troy Noon's An Absolute Podcast. You can rate, review, subscribe on iTunes, on Blog Talk, and Go Orange.
Go Orange. Finish 10th.